Hello and welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show all about how science plays out in our cultural creations. Sometimes we talk about the science behind popular TV and movies. Other times we talk to artists and authors about the research that influenced their works, or food scientists about cultures of a bacterial kind, and more. Today we've got a special musical guest. Scottish composer Erland Cooper, that's him you're hearing right now, is known for playful, innovative, experimental projects. For example, he actually buried the only audio copy of one of his 2021 compositions. Then he left treasure hunt clues for people to try to find it, which one couple eventually did. In his newest album, Folded Landscapes, he is deep in conversation with the environment and our changing climate. The seven movements of the piece were recorded with the Scottish Ensemble Chamber Orchestra in both sub-zero temperatures and a sweltering studio. He then exposed the audio master tape to the sun on the UK's hottest day in history in July of last year, audibly altering the fidelity of the sound. One movement includes the voices of climate activists and news reports in a cacophonous montage. He's encased recording equipment in ice, recreated the acoustics of glacial caves in Norway's Svalbard, and performed acts of what he calls slow activism in the name of celebrating and cherishing the natural world and encouraging us to change. Writer Arwa Haider interviewed him earlier this year. I hope you enjoy.
This is the midsection of an 8-foot sculpture.
Wow.
And I thought it would be great for us to put the hydrophone, which is a microphone for recording underwater, inside the ice. So we can kind of hear what the ice hears. So the sculptor is pointing at the piano. And inside that, we've got this kind of block that's got a drilled hole in the top, which we're going to place some water and then the hydrophone itself. Mm-hmm. And we'll test if it's working.
It's so beautiful to look at, and also kind of entrancing to listen to as well, because obviously while I'm listening to you, I can hear this kind of
dripping
backdrop rhythm of, yeah, just this sort of gentle but persistent.
So I've done this once. This is the second time. So the water's being collected in a Pelly case, which has normally got a tape machine in it, and it's just the perfect size for it. It's almost like a little fountain.
I was wondering, Erland, I mean, there is such a gentleness and wonder to the work that you create, both in terms of the music and the visual aspects of it and the ingredients that you put together. But I mean, to me, it feels like activism as well. Would you consider yourself an activist as an artist?
I think artists, whether their activism is personal, internal or external, they all kind of contain or obtain that to some point. I don't like to be divisive. I like to let people come to things, come up with their own views and engage in conversation rather than make statements. And this is, you know, where it's an opportunity to celebrate and cherish the natural world. So what a fantastic thing. I mean, activism is a curious thing, isn't it? Some are more outspoken than others. I think I like to do things in a gentle manner where people can engage with it, come into it, bring their conversations, their points of view, or just come and sit in silence. Art has the ability to kind of make you feel something. Generally, when you feel something, you make changes. And music in particular is a really good catalyst for that. So I suppose I wanted this project to kind of be something that people could come and celebrate the themes, talk about them, engage with them in a world that isn't quite as cacophonous, isn't quite as violent. But I would call it a slow violence of change. You know, you never look at paint drying. You never watch a sculpture melt. Yet you and I are sat here transfixed.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
The last 5-10 minutes.
I kind of can't take my eyes off the sculpture. I'm looking at you when you're talking, but
it's meditative.
I like that phrase, slow violence, because there's, it's almost, in spite of itself, a very beautiful phrase.
Yeah.
You know, it almost sounds like,
well,
like ballet.
It does. Now, that's a nice way to look at it. I think of it in its cruelest and most beautiful terms of aging. Aging is the ultimate slow violence of change, isn't it? Where it happens to us all. We change, but you don't notice. One day you wake up with a grey hair, or you wake up with a wrinkle that wasn't there the day before. Or did it progressively come? Who knows? It's about noticing the detail. And I think then when you notice these details, they become really more interesting. And that links back to the work that I hope to celebrate, which really just is about finding the magic of the everyday, you know, finding the natural world in a city in East London. Every day I try to find a little pocket of that. It's important, you know, whether it's something cruel, like a pigeon that's run over on the road and I put it to one side, or a cat that's been abandoned and has ended up in my studio to fix itself for 3 months, or just a little park or a little green space in a council estate, or like the other day where I heard the peregrine falcon in the Barbican Towers. You can hear it and then celebrate and enjoy it. And for me, it gives me a kind of, it's like a energy, a life force, I suppose.
Yeah, it is a life-affirming thing, I think, particularly when it's an unexpected addition to your environment. But when I came to meet you today at your studio, I was just thinking, like, I mean, I know this part of East London well, but it feels like it must contrast so strongly with your background when you were a kid, because you obviously grew up on Orkney. Mm. And I'm really curious about how, from an early age, how that environment, how that landscape shaped how you came to kind of approach your creative work. In addition to that, your parents were scientists as well, weren't they? That they all feel,
yes,
like...
Yes, Dad studied zoology. My mother studied geography, and I went to university. My parents are academic. My siblings are all very academic, doctors and things like that. And so we all studied. We all went to university. I didn't study classical music. I didn't study the arts. And I wish I did. I wish I'd had that opportunity. It just never crossed my mind to suggest it as an idea.
What did you study originally?
I started mechanical engineering and economics, and focused on the economics for one reason and one reason only. It meant I could travel, and it took me to Budapest and Cadiz in Spain, all the while making music. I remember my father had a master key for the school. It could open every door, you know. Every Yale lock, it would open in the school. And I used to pinch it from his top pocket. I never asked. I'm sure he would have let me, but I pinched it. And I think I was the only kid breaking into the school to use the music room to figure out how to play the piano, to figure out how to work tape machines. I remember this went on for about 3 months, and I thought I had a rapport with the janitor. And then he told on me. Mr. Cooper, your son seems to be in the school before school and after school and at the weekends. Should he be?
That's such a shame you were busted, because it sounds like you kind of created your own playground in there.
Well, Dad then let me. And while all my mates were in the playground or playing football, I was in the music room alone. Not much has changed. I'm still creating, like the studio we're in now, in these safe havens hidden away working. The only thing that's different is I now collaborate, and it's the greatest joy working with incredible musicians like Daniel Puro, the violinist, and, you know, the Scottish Ensemble. It's such a privilege, and I'm able to do that, and I can write this work and then collaborate with these people. So that's the major change.
No, I can hear what you're saying. And obviously collaboration, both in terms of working with other musicians and artists and working with scientists as well, plays such a key role in the latest projects that I'm aware have come to light. Your last album, Folded Landscape, and also the accompanying piano album. Can you tell me a little bit more about those projects, how they came to fruition?
Well, it's interesting, actually, the more I think about how science played such an important role for my parents and then in their education of us, the outside world, being imperative in our upbringing and understanding of animals and their ecosystems. You know, it was by default, we were taught this every day and encouraged to value that. So science has always played a major role in this feeling of exploration. And I wrote a trilogy of work about the islands, the elements themselves, air, sea, and land. And a writer had written in one of the broadsheets that, you know, there was this clickbait of a headline or whatever, and it said, "Nature's songwriter." And whilst my colleagues were high-fiving, I felt quite embarrassed inside because it's hyperbole. What's the word?
Hyperbole. It is kind of hyperbole. I mean, it is such a good soundbite because I can see that repetitively.
Yes.
Sort of stalking you since
it
then.
Stalks me, but then I thought, okay, if that's going to stalk me, work it harder. Work harder. I had a conversation with my dad. We would talk about science and we talk about nature, what nature represents, the elements themselves. And I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to be called that, I need to collaborate with nature on a much deeper level than the elemental, just the you know, the idea of changing weather and things like that, or a sense of place. My music's always got, I hope, always has a feeling of a sense of place. It's really important. It's a landscape that creates an internal landscape. That's what I'm trying to work on. And I thought, how could I go a little bit deeper? How could I dig into the soil a bit harder? And then I thought, the soil itself. So just before this Folded Landscapes project, I recorded a classical work, my first kind of concerto for violin for Daniel Pioro and his studio collective. Mm-hmm. Recorded them up at the RCS in Glasgow, an institution I could only dream of going in as a child, and being able to go in an almost maverick manner, record this work, and everybody signed an NDA. And the reason they signed the NDA was they would be the only people that would hear it in that form. I put it on to a quarter inch spool of tape, which you see in front of you. I deleted every digital file that existed from the finished mix. I took that tape, travelled 1,000 miles back to Orkney from London, and buried it, or planted it, as I like to say, in the soil, about 3 foot deep, in a location special to me. And on top of the tape, and the tape was just in the soil, pure, you know, pure touching the earth and the minerals and the water. On top of the tape was a biscuit tin with a score and a letter from me. If you find this, you know how to get it back to me. And on top of that was a fiddle. And then I filled it with earth. And then put on top of that effectively X marks the spot, but it was my own special Norwegian or Scandinavian rune, mm-hmm. a rune stone. And to cut a long story short, the reason I did that was two or threefold. One, an opportunity for the soil as this kind of aleatoric element in the creation of the music, it would cause the tape to disintegrate effectively. The magnetic tape doesn't like soil. It doesn't like moisture. It doesn't like different pH levels. It doesn't like sunlight. It doesn't like salt. But I kind of like what a controlled amount of those articles can do to the tape, and it creates these artifacts of sound, these drops, these crackles, these breaks, these kind of splurgy, gloopy noises. So that really interested me. I could put it all onto the tape. There's only one copy that exists, so all of a sudden it becomes valuable. And by valuable, I mean has a value to me. It suddenly becomes precious. And so for me, it was a meditation on what's valuable in the arts anymore, in a world where everything is so instant and free and you can get it. There's millions of bits of music uploaded every Friday. Is it as precious as it used to be?
And you buried this tape this tape in 2021, I think.
That's right.
And so the actual revelation is
it's coming.
June 2024.
And what's wonderful?
London's Barbican Centre.
That's right. But the most wonderful thing to me is it was found.
Yeah, how long did that take?
It lasted half of its 3 years. And when I was chatting to my dad, he said, well, it might not have survived another Orkney winter. There might actually be some music on it. He's right. So when these two wonderful couple, a tape enthusiast and a local projectionist in the cinema in Orkney, and they had been following the clues that I'd been releasing and into the world. And I got a phone call out of the blue saying, hello, got your tape. And I thought it was a tape delivery upstairs. And I said, oh, just come round the back. It's the cobbled street beside this. There's a black door, number 26. They said, no, we've got your tape in the back of our car. It's a bit gammy and there's a rather mucky looking violin. And I sat down and I just said, tell me everything. I suddenly felt incredibly precious. I said, don't get it hot or don't put it by the fridge or pull out the spool. All of a sudden it became so precious, but I had put it in the ground a year and a half earlier.
That's so funny that your relationship with it kind of transformed within
changed.
That. Yeah, yeah. Within that sort of second of realizing it actually hadn't been lost. And
I had to get a sense of who they were. Understanding who they are, and they're such kind people.
They seemed really dedicated towards finding this.
Well, Victoria and Dan Rose deserve some sort of medal because, well, they actually get the stone as a gift. I think that's what they get in the end. And they're going to come to the concert as my guests and
we'll
talk about it. But they found it not by the clues, although the clues in a way helped them find the geographical point on the island. They found it by rock formation based on a photograph of a rock beside my feet.
I mean, I like the fact that so much of what you've been doing here is an unknown quantity and it's kind of it's left to the elements. You're collaborating,
with
as you
nature.
Said, deeply with the earth and with
nature
rather than obviously taking themes of nature as inspiration is not a new concept.
That's
but actually,
right.
It would be really exciting to see and obviously hear what happens in June 2024. But in the meantime, and as you said, obviously this wasn't the only project that you've been immersed in the last couple of years. And when the tapes for Car of the Runes came to light, you were already set to release a beautiful album earlier in 2023, Folded Landscapes. And in addition to that, you've created a piano album.
Mm.
And again, the relationship with the earth and temperature in particular is really key here. Tell me a bit more.
Temperature, yes. It was only a matter of time before I wrote a piece of work that touched on the themes of time, temperature, and conversation surrounding climate change. And I'd been working on it for a while, actually, a couple of years in between things. And I thought, I think this is ready. It was a collaboration with Scottish Ensemble. Firstly, I thought it would be interesting to record them at sub-zero temperatures. So these classical musicians, you know, these incredible virtuoso musicians, I took them into a factory in Glasgow, January the 8th, post-lockdown, and recorded them at -2 or -1 or just below zero. And they all had their kind of mini gloves, you know, the fingerless gloves, and big jackets and beanie hats. And I had a heat source that I would only turn on after the takes because it was so loud, you know. And it was such fun. Again, the faces, the smiles were beaming with this childlike wonder because it was something different to them and to me. And I recorded sketches, 8-20 sketches, lots of things to do with the narrative. I asked them to record, write back, play the score backwards and do all sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
This idea of playing with a timeline. Anyway, I took that away, then kept writing. So I took these sketches and developed those sketches into a kind of beefier body of work and then took them to the studio. So we've now gone to 20 degrees and I slowly turned that up. So by the end of the session, it was like 30 degrees. Controlling the temperature. So we've basically gone from this sub-zero to kind of 30 degrees in the studio. We're hot and sweaty and that was a kind of a process to really get under the fingernails of rising temperatures. And it's a multi-movement work, the original album, that kind of starts in the Sub-Zero, and by the end it's basically thawing over seven movements. And the first 1 to 4 movements are probably quite austere, you know, it's a steep glacial ascent. And then it's like a toboggan ride of hope down the other end on side B. That's what I was hoping for. You know, there's this kind of Scottish classical ceilidh on the sixth movement, and I have a fond memory of sweating in the studio as they were vigorously playing. It contrasted against the original recordings.
I love that idea of toboggan ride of hope, because I mean, I feel like listening to that work, there are such complex emotions. It's a very beautiful piece of work. Because of the themes, there's a real poignant quality, and I often feel like there's a fragile beauty to some of the compositions, but there is an enduring hope as well.
Mm.
I guess it's a tricky, as adults, our kind of responsibility in terms of, you know, being custodians of, you know, what future generations will have to live with. And also just the fact that we're now conscious that, you know, we're dealing with something that requires a proactive change in some way to counter,
yes,
environmental damage. But at the same time, you know, what's going to get us through that if we don't believe that some good can come off that proactive change?
It was very kind of you to listen and to say such lovely things about the work, and that it evokes certain feelings. And I think, you know, we both have children, and our children's children and their children's children will inherit our wins and our losses and our mistakes, and that's obvious. But what's quite apparent to a lot of people is there's a cacophony of sound. There's a moment in movement 5, the start of movement 5, where you hear so many voices, familiar voices, Greta, for example, and she's contrasted with a news report from the 70s, you know, this is 40, 50 years earlier, saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment is not just about those personalities. It's quite the opposite. It's actually just about noise. This kind of echo chamber of opinion, and which is, it can be quite antagonistic. It can provoke and poke as well. And when that happens, my observations are when that happens too rapidly, or too, when it gets so heated, it can actually have the opposite effect.
Sure.
People don't change, they switch off.
Or they knee-jerk against it. Which,
or they,
I think,
fight against, yeah, it. And so I wanted it to feel like a kind of cacophony and then go into a kind of arpeggio of strings that represent birds flying as well as the sound of an ambulance. I don't think I've mentioned that, but it's actually...
I'm not sure I picked up on the ambulance.
Yeah, would get that.
I'll go back to it and hear it.
A siren.
Hear it.
But also, those seven movements, I did one other thing, which was I again put the recording on a tape. I didn't plant it or bury it. I put it on my studio roof on what happened to be the hottest day of recorded time in the UK, and it got completely sunburnt. And I then took that sunburnt tape and mixed it into the finished audio. So it's running in parallel with the clean master. The clean audio signal is running in parallel with the distorted,
amazing,
sunburnt one.
What did it look and sound like, the sunburnt tape?
It's here somewhere. Well, actually, Blue Peter moment. This is exactly as how it sounded.
That's amazing that you had it ready right there.
I thought about it. I thought you'd be interested. So if you listen to this, you'll hear these kind of... pops and crackles.
There's a real intensity to it, that's for sure. Right.
These dropouts, these breaks. It really distorts and it really gets all crunchy. kind of quite ugly to most people, but I rather like it. There's a beauty to it.
I have to say, I like it as well, and I think it's partly because growing up listening to all kinds of different dance music, industrial music, the kind of gnarliness of it actually appeals to me.
It's gnarly.
Yeah. I kind of feel like it's very textural and kind of makes me want to, like, really...
And you hear those clicks.
Yes. But again, even that I kind of like.
There's a musicality to it.
There is a musicality in the same... Well, not in the same way, but what kind of sprung to mind is when you get a really dirty piece of vinyl that hasn't been cleaned and all the kind of pops and fuzz that you hear on that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's for very different reasons, but... And that's... Yeah, that's... That's well, such a cool thing to do. How hot was it that day? Because I know we've had some crazy temperatures in London.
It was 40.2, I think, was the recorded temperature.
So it's kind of taking the music to extremes, both in terms of, yeah, well, heat what, and
what,
cold.
What I wanted to do, maybe I'm trying to articulate this, is as the movements are thawing, these seven movements are progressing, the fidelity of the audio is getting worse. But the composition is becoming more hopeful. So over seven movements, as the music arguably becomes more hopeful, reaches a climax of a Cayley, underneath, the fidelity is getting worse and worse. And that was my only kind of statement, a kind of observation. I remember looking out the window. It was on a particularly hot February or something, and people were in T-shirts in Victoria Park. Dancing to the End of Days, but online it was doom, gloom, fight and flight. And I thought, well, you should celebrate and cherish the natural world at all times. But it did make me think that there's also a kind of ignorance to the fragility below you. And so I thought, well, that would be a neat way to put it in, would be to, if the music's getting happier, but underneath it's getting worse and worse, and actually a little bit more mono, and it's becoming more, you know, its stereo field is becoming narrower and it's popping and cracking. And so that was all I wanted to do with it. And so when asked to do this companion piece,
this piano album,
I'd never done just a pure piano album, and I thought to myself, I understand, you know, the idea here is we've got quite a complex string, poetry, field recordings. There's a lot going on, this seven-piece, seven-movement work. It'd be interesting to see if I could just play it so simply on the piano in seven movements, which was a great challenge for me, and actually much harder than I thought.
Right.
It was great. So it was lovely to take all these melodies. And because I'm not, you know, I write on the instrument, but I'm not. You know, I can't play Chopin. I can't, you know, I play by ear, and I write and I can read music, of course. But I thought it would be a great challenge to arrange these with a colleague. So I can't play them. So I have to learn to play them. So I arranged them with a lot of sustain and decay and really slow, almost like it's really down tempo furniture music. I did that, I arranged it, and then I was thinking, okay, well, how can I record it in a way that's interesting to me? And I thought, I wonder how the ice would hear the music. So I thought, why don't I put one of the microphones for recording the piano in a block of ice, and that ice will thaw, and you might hear these little drips, and it might kind of inform the recording. So that was the kind of first of two ideas. And the second idea was to, instead of taking a piano to a cave, a glacial cave in Norway, and recording there, which is an incredibly gluttonous thing to do, I thought, could I take the acoustic, the reverb of the cave, and bring it to my studio? So the recording captured in that three-dimensional space, bring it back to my studio and mix with it. And technology allows us to do that now. So then I thought, oh, cool, I could mix the piano album, first record it with one of the mics in an ice cube, big ice block, and secondly, the reverb, the echo, which is quite common to use in recording since the 50s. We've used echo to make voices feel warmer or feel sound like they're in an auditorium, for example.
Yeah, add atmosphere.
But
I thought it'd be cool to mix the piano with the sound of a glacial cave. And I found these group of scientists that had done a whole bunch of field recordings in Svalbard in Norway, this glacial caves. And then there's a piece of software, which to me was kind of a game changer in mixing, because it meant I could really take a place and mix it into my music. Mm. And I've done it a lot with Orkney.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how it works when you drop a hydrophone into that block of ice?
I thought we should just do it.
I mean, I really, you know, you don't often get to see something demonstrated like that. So absolutely, I'd love to.
Well, so on this particular block, we've got a large hole which we've drilled into the top, which I'm filling with water.
All of these sounds are very satisfying. Even the water, like, filling up the cube.
Well, you see, what a recording studio does is it encourages you to hear every nuanced detail, so you can hear our tummies rumble or the water splash.
Yes, the tummy rumbling, I apologise for. why does it, with a, obviously it's a hydrophone, but I mean, what does the water do? Why does it need water? Why can't you just stick the microphone in the ice?
Well, this, I did the first one, and I found the results.
Were they muffled?
Yeah, a bit like kind of, it takes the top kind of 20,000 hertz down to 3,000. It scoops that off a little bit, becomes more muffled. I wanted to try this different approach for two reasons. One, this is a loaned hydrophone, which is very expensive, and I didn't want to just stick it in the freezer. And I thought, I wonder if it was to just kind of float in the water in a hole in a block of ice, so kind of be more submerged rather than just frozen. It might give a more accurate sound to what it would be like to be inside a block of ice.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they were originally tools for science to submerge underneath lakes and rivers and things like that.
I think I saw a documentary with Ryuichi Sakamoto in the Arctic, and he must have been using a hydrophone, but he was sort of talking about fishing for sounds, which I thought was just so charming.
It's lovely. Yeah. I've taken that term because I love that interview, and I love his work, and
yeah,
that film is wonderful. But yeah, it's fishing for sounds. So we're fishing in the ice. Even dipping it in made it feel a bit more like fishing.
The clarity of the ice is really striking me as well. I mean, it kind of looks iridescent, doesn't it?
And in the last hour, it's probably melted about an inch of water.
Well, there's been this constant backdrop, hasn't there? And you know, you kind of think that you start thinking that you can predict the rhythm, but then it kind of, it's unpredictable.
It is unpredictable.
Because you get these little tiny torrents as well.
It does. I mean, I suppose it's kind of, so it's in the middle of a, how thick do you think that is? So kind of 5-6 inches in effectively a pool of water. And I'm interested how sound travels through different substances. I recorded, so if that's all set up, you can imagine, I would then record the piano with the three mics, two microphones on the piano here, and then that main one. Hearing it melt.
Yeah.
It's so lovely.
Absolutely. That was just glorious. You know, there's a few moments on the piano and then just the water. It was almost like a kind of unpredictable duet, I guess.
It wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the unpredictability side is, it is a duet. But then that is the fine tapestry of life for us, really. Deep ecology and living with the natural world is a duet in itself, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and I think maybe we've had a sort of certain reawakening to that in recent years, both in terms of the elements and also just other creatures around us as well. You know, one of the first things that you said when I met you was, you know, just this excitement at hearing an unfamiliar bird call very early in the morning, and, and the fact that you were hearing a peregrine in the heart of the City of London.
Hunting.
Yeah, hunting.
Having its breakfast of a pigeon.
And then finding its breakfast later on. But yeah, the kind of the beauty and the brutality of that is really something. I think the final thing I wanted to ask you, if that's okay, is that you're about to go out on tour both across the UK and you've got European dates as well. And I'm really curious about how you're going to present this latest work to a live audience.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I suppose I've done it with a large ensemble and I wanted to see if I could make it more intimate. So I'm doing it with a quartet and I've taken some of the movements and rearranged some of them so that they involve the piano versions as well as the orchestra, so they can kind of combine with the strings. But equally, I'm playing some of my Orkney songs. And I hope that as a bunch of repertoire of music, it's really just a celebration of the natural world and an opportunity to kind of go on a little journey through different places and spaces.
It sounds absolutely brilliant. And I love how it's coming together and constantly evolving with this fluidity as a body of work. Erlen Cooper, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Would you like a nice drink?
Yes. That sounds very refreshing. I don't mind if I do.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Lab from New Scientist Podcasts. That was Arwa Haider in conversation with Scottish composer Erlen Cooper. And we'll put Arwa's lovely piece about him in the show notes. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it. Plus, our weekly news podcast and other special treats drop every Friday and Tuesday. Find more of the great journalism from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.